Live from Western Canada, welcome to The Kindling's Muse. Intelligent, imaginative, hospitable explorations of ideas that matter most in contemporary life. And now here's your host, Bill Hogg.
Well, a warm welcome to our live audience and welcome to ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, lads and lassies who join us on our podcast at thekindlings.ca. In 1985, Neil Postman published his most celebrated work, Amusing Ourselves to Death, Public Discourse in the Age of Show Business. Postman bemoaned the influence of television with these words: "What Orwell feared were those who would ban books. What Huxley feared was that there would be no reason to ban a book, for there would be no one who wanted to read one. Orwell feared those who would deprive us information. Huxley feared those who would give us so much that we would be reduced to passivity and egoism. Orwell feared that the truth would be concealed from us. Huxley feared the truth would be drowned in a sea of irrelevance. Orwell feared we would become a captive culture. Huxley feared we would become a trivial culture, preoccupied with some equivalent of the feelies, the orgy porgy, and the centrifugal bumble puppy." And tonight at The Kindlings, we will explore the influence of social media and, in light of the proliferation of Facebook and Twitter, ask the question that Neil Postman framed in 1985: are we amusing ourselves to death? Our society is saturated with social media. Each day we are bombarded with Facebook updates, MySpace, Twitter, with its proliferation of tweets. And of course, there's millions of blogs on the blogosphere. What would Neil Postman say about this trend? Joining me tonight are Kindling's regulars, Dr. Alison Jewell and Peter Chataway. Dr. Alison Jewell is a published author and the co-director of the Gender Studies Institute at Trinity Western University in Langley, beautiful British Columbia. Please welcome Dr. Alison Jewell. Then we have movie critic, all-around nice guy, and Ron Howard fanboy, Peter Chataway. Please welcome Peter Chataway. Peter is the Canadian encyclopedia of all things cinematic, so it's always great to have Peter as part of our panel. But joining us for the very first time is Dr. Carson Pugh, who is the president of Arrow Leadership, and is called to develop leaders worldwide to, quote, be led more by Jesus, lead more like Jesus, and to lead more to Jesus. The International Service Center for Arrow Leadership is located in Vancouver, BC, and has been highly successful in polishing 1,300 leaders in 8 countries worldwide. Carson is the best-selling author of Mentoring Leaders: Wisdom for Developing Character, Calling, and Competency. And he is known through his speaking at conferences, published articles, and his appearances as a ninja on radio programs, and his commentaries. Over 50,000 leaders now read his monthly leadership emails to the point. And tonight, together, our panel will tackle the topic of social media. Every day we are bombarded with Facebook updates. Facebook has recently ousted Google as the most popular U.S. website, with just over 7% of all U.S. web traffic. Facebook is huge, with 400 million registered users. MySpace, Twitter, and the blogosphere are part of this new cultural landscape that we find ourselves in, and new applications have arrived on the landscape. Blippi, which gives updates of your purchases to all and sundry. There is Foursquare, a mobile social network that allows people to announce their precise location to the world. And the iPhone has a Skimble application, which allows you to skimble how many push-ups you've done or how many Tim Hortons Timbits you've consumed in the past hour. How should we respond to the possibilities and perils of social media? And so we'll turn to our panel. Let's get the ball rolling by asking each of our illustrious panelists if they would subscribe to Blippi, where you give the moderators of Blippi a credit card of your choice, and then for everyone to see, they know how much money you spent at the gas station, how much money you spent at Starbucks, how much money you spent at Canadian Superstore, Best Buy, you name it. So we'll turn to Carson Pugh and ask Carson, do you subscribe to Blippi? Would you subscribe to Blippi?
I'm not a current subscriber to Blippi, but I think actually you could have a lot of fun with this. If you selected the credit card that you want to use to send the messages out, then I could actually choose what I want to actually, you know, show people that I'm spending money on. Would I want them to see every transaction? No, not at all. But I wouldn't mind being a little playful with it.
Okay. Thanks, Carson. Allison.
No. I have not joined Blippi. I would never, ever, ever do something like that. I think that I'm fairly private and I want it that way. And it would be horrifying for me to think I was that exposed and that I would even contribute to that exposure. No.
Okay.
So that's no then?
That's a no. Yeah.
Okay. We're hoping that one of these Kindlings, Allison, will actually speak and share what's on her mind.
Yeah.
So
next time.
Peter, what about Peter Chataway and Blippi? Is it a love affair made in heaven?
I don't know if I'd even heard of Blippi before this.
Sit next to me and you'll be educated, Peter.
Well, is there anything that a person gets out of this? I mean, do they help you get like cash back at the end of it or anything? Or do they do your taxes for you? Or is it all, they're just reporting what you spend, that's it?
They're just reporting transactions. So I think it's an issue of technology in pursuit of a purpose.
What's the purpose?
Exactly. What is the purpose?
I can understand being playful with it and saying, people have like their personal credit card and their business card.
Right.
Well, this is my personal credit card.
This is my
business
Blippi
card. And this is my, just to mess with people's minds card. Or something.
Right.
I could see doing that. But I mean, if I did that, I'd be afraid that I'd get them mixed up. I don't, it's not something I could see myself doing, really.
So why in the world, Allison used the word exposure. Why in the world would people allow this level of exposure about their transactions?
Well, I don't know, but we live in a culture where people are increasingly exposing themselves in general. I mean, people setting up webcams that send out a constant stream of images from their living room, so you can watch them as they watch TV, or you can watch them as they have sex, or you can watch them. There are people who have lived very openly this way over the past decade or more, and compared to that, a credit card might not be quite as exposed. But
I think it's creepy. It's just creepy.
Well, sure it is. But
Allison,
people,
do you have loyalty cards for that you use for anything?
No. No no
no, no,
no,
no,
no,
no.
I just, okay, yeah. Part of me thinks that it's so egocentric that why would anybody be that interested in you? And why do you think you would be that interesting to anyone? It just seems incredibly self-involved.
So there's the issue of exposure. There's also the issue of security, where recently five Blippi subscribers have had their credit card details published to the global cyberspace community. So that's probably reason for concern there. It leads me to the next question, though. As we ask each of our panel in turn, in the cyberspace superhighway, how connected are you? How plugged in are you? How much do you use the new social media? Carson?
I'm fairly plugged in. I work in a global context where we've got people that I'm working with literally around the world. So we use technology to make that all happen. But I also, I'm a heavy Facebook user and I have Twitter accounts, which I use well and badly. So part of it is how we function. Now, it also is that part of it is a marketing thing. It's a branding thing more than it is a thing that I'm into. So it's a way that we use to, it's part of branding, really.
Okay. Allison, how plugged in are you?
No. I'm not on Facebook. I don't Twitter. I do have an email account that I use for work mainly. I do own a cell phone, but I have to remember to plug it in to recharge. Otherwise I can go days, weeks without ever, ever, ever thinking about it.
Would you care to divulge your cell phone number to our audience?
No, no, no.
Oh, okay. just sort of check in there. Now, is there a reason for that?
Well, I sort of feel like it's the more accessible I am, then the more, I don't know, danger I could get into. And I think it could be because what I do for a living, working at Trinity Western University, students, you know, hundreds of students per semester, and most of the emails are really just messages and memos, often between myself and my students. And they're very short, and they might be something like, so-and-so can't make it to class on Wednesday because of doctor's appointment, see you Thursday instead, is that okay? That kind of message, which I really enjoy, like I like that kind of connection, and I prefer it over the phone for that kind of thing.
Yeah, sure.
But if it got into more, I don't know, if it got into trickier conversations about wanting to be exempted from some assignment or something, I would sort of want those conversations in person.
Mm-hmm.
And if someone was sort of relying on that kind of technology, it would remove remove an important part of relationship, which would be face-to-face context where you can see the person's face, catch their tone, connect in a more intuitive way.
Okay, thanks, Allison. Peter, how plugged in are you?
Well, I've had a blog for a few years. I've had email for about 16 years. I have a Facebook account, and I generally use it to keep in touch with some friends and to post links to things I find amusing or distracting or whatever. I also love the ability to read my email and various websites on my cell phone, which I think is a fantastic thing. And I live in Syria, a friend of mine lives in Vancouver, and every now and then when we try to meet, we say, okay, well, turn your Google Latitude on so we can actually look at a satellite image of Vancouver on our cell phones, and we can see little dots, one for me, one for him, to see how close we are to meeting.
But then you can see each other just like drones from 24.
Yeah.
Hovering above.
Sure.
Allison doesn't have that.
No, I don't. I don't have that.
But of course, the reason my friend and I do this is precisely because we are going to meet in person, and we want to get a sense of how, like, are we there yet? Are you there yet? Are we, like, so the end goal of this is meeting face-to-face. So.
What about Skype? Do you use Skype?
I used it once. And it was just voice. There was no picture.
Okay.
But I'm intrigued to use it in the future, but I haven't really gotten into it.
Well, I used it once when my daughter was studying it in Greece, and it was all set up, and we were all excited. We were going to, you know, look at each other face to face, but there was some weird picture problem, and she looked more like a Martian than my daughter, and I found it very upsetting, and I preferred
I like Martians.
So you made a clean break from Skype after the Martian encounter.
That's right,
Okay. Now, when we talk about social networking, the leader of the pack is Facebook with 400 million subscribers. How do we account for the incredible popularity of Facebook, its meteoric exponential growth, and the level of subscription?
I have no idea.
Okay.
I really don't. Like it's like a tsunami right now in terms of its popularity.
I think Facebook looks better than MySpace, for example.
Oh, yes.
I think the design is relatively clean and simple.
Yeah.
What's particularly amazing is that Facebook continues to get bigger and bigger despite the fact that every 6 months it does something that really ticks off its users.
Right.
Every
right.
6 months it changes the privacy rules or it changes the format or something, and everybody gets really upset, and friends of mine have said, okay, I'm going to boycott Facebook from now on, and within 3 months we're all back on. So
I think Carson might be onto something around branding, because the ones I've seen, not that I own a Facebook account, I don't, but when I've, you know, looked at my daughter's or whatever, when she's shown me, it looks like people are kind of branding themselves, like, this was my holiday at the beach,
right.
And this is how great I looked in the swimsuit, so I want you to see that. And then over here, this is my, you know, luncheon with my friends and how much fun we were having, and I kind of want you to see me like that as a personal branding.
Projecting a persona.
Yeah, and that's probably very addictive, because you get to craft yourself in that kind of...
Reinvent yourself in cyberspace.
Yeah.
So we'll combine.
And it's very comprehensive because it includes photos, which other people would do on Flickr, and it includes notes, which is similar to having a blog. And you know, just a few weeks ago, my wife and I put an apartment up for sale, and our real estate agent stuck it on Facebook. There's like a Facebook app or something for real estate listings, which is kind of weird. And so like Facebook, it covers almost every aspect of life, and so it's very easy for people to sort of treat Facebook as their one-stop shop for networking.
But what about the trivialization of communication? So in Neil Postman's seminal work, Amusing Ourselves to Death, he talks about a debate that took place between Abraham Lincoln and Frederick A. Douglass that took place across 7 hours. So you've got a seven-hour discourse where there's a thesis communicated for an hour and a half, then there's a half-hour rebuttal, and then there's, okay, let's go for an evening meal. We need a break. And so then they go and have a meal, and then there's antithesis, and then there's counterpoint. And so across 7 hours, this isn't amongst the university Illuminati. This is Joe and Sally regular who are hanging out, and they're listening to this incredibly engaging discourse. And then you've got Twitter, where you're limited to 140 characters. And I'm new to Facebook. I was pressured into Facebook with the family. They said, hey, you can't do the Kindlings and not be on Facebook. And I made comments about I could make an assessment about the benefits of crack without using crack, but I'm now on Facebook. But what I've noticed is it's the trivial updates that get the most traffic. So, for example, I reported on Saturday that my breakfast consisted of pizza, coffee, yogurt, and the sweet taste of a Manchester United victory. That got a lot of comments. But then I made a comment quoting Rabbi Abraham Herschel, who said, if God is not of supreme importance, he's of no importance at all. So it's one of the dangers we're facing, a trivialization of discourse and a dumbing down of exchange of ideas between people.
Yeah, I would say yes. I think that there's something very, very important in actual conversations face-to-face that go on and meander into various sort of dead ends of conversation and then meander on back to something else that I don't think is possible with a kind of technologically based connection like an email message or a Twitter or a Facebook message. I think that those are short glimpses of content that are maybe, you know, branding or message updating or communicating so you can locate your friends, so you can get together for coffee. But I can't imagine I don't think it could be that meaningful to have a very long, engaged conversation.
What I'm watching really closely right now is with a younger generation of leader that I'm mentoring, I'm concerned about their ability to think deeply about much. They seem to have, they don't seem to go deep. And I'm wondering if part of it is this culture that they're living in with the brevity of communication, with the wanting instant responses to everything. I watch my son get frustrated if somebody doesn't tweet him right back. I just sent that. You know, why haven't I heard from you? And there's no, everything's about brevity and everything's about speed and it's not about depth. So in terms of the conversations that usually mean the most to us in our lives are those where we've just gone, you know, to a new depth with a friend or with somebody that you're talking to. And I'm concerned that I think kind of friendship is changing and is Facebook redefining what we mean by friend?
It seems so demanding, too, that there's an accountability to respond instantly. There's a feature on the email at work, anyway, that the message might come from, I don't know, the secretary of the department, and the secretary apparently has requested a confirmation that you've seen this email, and there's something on her computer that she can see that you've opened it. And, oh, that just ruined it for me. I thought, half the fun was the mystery of, well, I saw it, but I'm going to take time to respond now because, but now I can't even do that because someone knows I saw the message and time is now meaningful. So the more time I take, the more...
We're dealing with the immediacy of the communication.
Yeah.
And we've got to deal with the immediacy of a break. So we're going to take a break, and we're going to pick up the threads of the conversation and talk about how the social media impacts our definition of friendship and community. But we'll take a break. We'll be right back. Thanks for joining us at the Kindling's Muse. Welcome back to the Kindling's Muse, Western Canada, where we're all about hospitable, imaginative conversation about ideas that matter in contemporary life. We're talking about social media, and just before we took a break, we were beginning to ease into the issue of the redefinition of friendship. You know, Facebook has a limit as to how many friends you can have. It's 5,000 friends. I'm not there yet, because I've only been on Facebook for 2 weeks. But Facebook claims Facebook helps you connect and share with the people in your life. So the issue is, what are the quality of these friendships? What's the level of connection? I recall hearing Ajit Fernando, a theologian and the director of Youth for Christ in Sri Lanka, speaking about friendship. And I was bummed, because I was expecting him to speak on the uniqueness of Christ in a pluralistic culture, but he decided he would weave a path through the wisdom literature of the Old Testament and talk about friendships. And he said, biblical friendships are characterized by lingering conversations that linger over the truth. And now, is that a helpful definition? And then how does that square with the friends we find in cyberspace through Facebook, or its archaic opposite number, MySpace? Allison.
Yeah, well, my own impressions are that the kind of friends on MySpace, or my, what's it called? Facebook.
Facebook. There you go. It's called my book.
Right, okay.
It's my book. It's called your book, Allison.
Okay, right. Well, it just seems so surface. So, I mean, is it really a friend? In a full definition, no. It might be an acquaintance or someone you know or someone you met once or someone you knew in grade 9 that, oh yeah, I wonder what they're doing now. Not that you really were that close or you'd still be close to them now, but because it petered off, you know, now we're going to reconnect and now we're friends. It seems almost like an abuse of the word. I mean, it seems to set up a kind of popularity that is false. You know, all these people really care about you. Probably not, and it's...
Wow, you're such a cyber cynic.
Yeah, I prefer lingering conversations that have all the time in the world where a whole bunch of things are happening in the communion with someone and not just, you know, I had pizza for breakfast. That isn't that interesting, you know, a little bit interesting, but not profoundly important to... a relationship.
Well, Pete's on its own is only so interesting. You have to add a Manchester United victory to make it really...
That did make it more interesting.
Yeah,
I
that
agree.
Was a sweet taste. That's what made breakfast so good.
I find that I've had email now for 16 years, and I've had some really good friendships that have existed almost entirely through email exchanges back and forth. And we've had some, in some cases, some very lengthy emails. Sent back and forth, and in a few cases, I've eventually gone to meet these people in like foreign countries. Well, America anyway, but you know, to New Mexico, which is like
a foreign country within a foreign country.
And exactly, does it disappoint you because you had a certain image that was but you thought was existing?
No. Well, one or two cases maybe, but most of the time, when it gets to the point where we want to meet in person. It's been good. It's been instructive. It's been interesting, and we've stayed in touch afterwards. And I've greatly enjoyed it. But those are email, which is sort of a private thing. You can either email one person or you can email five. Facebook though is a little bit different because I mean, if you have hundreds of friends, and it's extremely easy to, once you get your grade school, your university friends, your church friends, the people you work with, and then all of their friends that you happen to meet at the theater that one night. I mean, it's very easy to accumulate friends on Facebook if you let it happen. And then especially on top of that, if you're a semi-public figure like me, I'm a writer, and so people who've read my stuff, they say, I want to be your friend. They say, yeah. They tag me with the friend button, and then they attach a note saying, Peter, I've enjoyed your writing in BC Christian News. And so, okay, well, you want to follow me? I'm fine with that. But I mean, do they care about me? Oh, maybe not, but whatever. You know, if you're a semi-public figure, then it's very easy to accumulate, you know, friends, quote unquote. And
but don't you ever think that?
And obviously, we don't linger over stuff, and it's especially weird when I post a single thing on my Facebook wall, and a friend from one part of my life, some atheist I know who's a friend of a friend or something, makes a comment, and then somebody from church posts a follow-up comment, and then somebody that I went to school with 30 years ago posts a comment, and suddenly they're all clashing together on my Facebook wall, and I don't even know what they're talking about. And
but don't you kind of feel that it gets out of your hands? Like on one hand, you have the power to brand yourself and control certain images that you want posted and blah, blah, blah. But at a certain point, it becomes like there's no more mystery, so that the more people know about you, maybe the less they'll find you interesting. Is that ever, you know?
Well,
maybe that's just me, but I sort of feel like the most chance I have is that they
don't know
all that much.
I seem to surprise people every now and then still, but well, that's a risk, I guess. But I mean, I don't see it as, I mean, there is an element of branding to it, but I don't see it entirely in those terms. I just happen to like keeping in touch with people. There are people that I haven't talked to on the phone in years, and even though they happen to live in the Vancouver area, but they post comments on my Facebook wall, and I post comments on theirs because we knew each other way back when. And you know, I'm grateful for that ability to stay in touch, even if that's all we do.
Okay, Carson, you like to add to the conversation?
Yeah, I think on the question of the friendship thing, I just find it's an interesting term that they used for describing this connection that you have. I like defriending people, which is, you know, if they annoy me on Facebook, I just defriend them and they're gone. But we're not talking about a real relationship here. We're really talking about some sort of a communication connection that may have potential, it may not have potential. But it's basically fairly shallow. Now, I would say I find blogs actually quite different. I find that a blog can have an opportunity to go a little bit deeper. There's a place for interaction that can happen on a blog, and I do appreciate that. But the whole Facebook thing I find pretty fluffy, actually. Yeah.
Now, Carson, you've been talking there about the quality of connection. It's shallow, but one of the remarkable things about Facebook and Twitter is the level of disclosure that takes place. What we'd say is we're suffering from excessive disclosure. Give you a couple of examples. Number one, 43-year-old Penelope Trunk, CEO of the aptly named Brazen Careerist blog, twittered her recent miscarriage. She said, I'm in a board meeting having a miscarriage. Thank goodness, because there's a blank 3-week hoop jump to have an abortion in Wisconsin. So there you've got no discretion and no boundaries, and maybe an example of the egoism that we referred to in the previous segment, or brazen self-promotion. And then Shelley Ross waited in hospital for word on her son, Bryson. And she posted this note to the social networking site Twitter. Please pray like never before. My 2-year-old fell in the pool. So obviously, if you believe in the power of prayer,
right,
you want people to be
mobilized
and approaching God on your behalf and asking God to intervene in his grace, his mercy, and power. But 19 minutes after that tweet, Bryson was dead. And she then proceeded to update her 5,300 Twitter followers with the news that her 2-year-old had died. So the little guy's corpse was still warm, and she's sending a tweet that he's dead. So why would you feel the need to tweet about your son's death when he's just passed away almost immediately? Why would you do that?
Well, I think in days gone past, with the death of a child, it would be followed up probably around the funeral or the service time that you'd put an ad in the newspaper, and you'd put a, either in the classified section usually, there'd be some sort of a notice that would go up there.
They'd be really brief too, mostly.
Pardon me?
They would be really brief in the newspaper.
Yes,
too.
Very brief. So I don't see it too different from that, except that we've had this, we're in this speeded up culture that is where everything happens instantly. So the fact that we can find out what happened right now, right after the water's still rippling in the pool,
right,
or whether it was in the newspaper a few days later, I think that the intent of broadcasting the news isn't that different. The media is different, and the speed is different.
Do you think, though, that it could undermine the people who are closer to the story, that 53,000 people know the same thing?
5,300.
Yeah, water, it does tend to water it down, because it's, who's special in your life?
You wonder, I mean, like, is every member of this person's family one of her Twitter followers?
That could be.
It could be, but if not, then you would think perhaps those people should be told first before the world at large hears about it. You know,
well, one of the things where she walked into a firestorm apparently was she was painting the chicken coop or working in the chicken coop while the little boy was in the pool, and she tweets that she's in the chicken coop doing whatever. And then a minute later, one of the little guy's siblings makes the 911 call to inform emergency services that he's fallen.
So she implicated herself.
Possibly. It was interesting that Amy Webb of Webb Media Group said there's something cathartic in asking a question or making a comment and eliciting feedback from a wide group of people, many of whom you may not know personally. So Amy Webb says to tweet 5,300 followers is cathartic, but is it some kind of twisted form of egoism that you would share this profoundly personal, harrowing experience with strangers?
You know, psychologists or psychiatrists would tell you that a person who doesn't have any filters on what they share is an indicator of not strong mental health. You know, so maybe there's a bunch of sick people out there. We've now provided with a media by which they can.
Maybe she was so addicted to it,
right,
that she wasn't even able to.
Yeah,
and it's just a habit.
You're right. I think there is a very addictive side to this whole thing, which we haven't really talked about.
Well, it's interesting you mentioned the addiction. You remember the old day experiment with the marshmallow, like where the subject in the experiment, there's a marshmallow put on a plate, and they're told if they leave the marshmallow alone, then they'll get another marshmallow. And invariably, most subjects in the marshmallow experiment consume the marshmallow in front of them. And Mel Laos, in an article just the other day from Christian Science Monitor, said Facebook is the digital marshmallow we cannot resist. So maybe there is something addictive to it.
Could you just say marshmallow one more time?
marshmallow. It's got four R's. Marshmallow. And if it's nae Scottish, it's crap. So there you go. We managed to slide that one in, although it was completely superfluous to the conversation.
That's one of your groups on Facebook, isn't it?
What's that?
If it's not Scottish?
That's right. Yeah, I joined that one. I joined a few groups, and the other day there I joined a beautiful group called If It's Not Scottish, It's Crap. So there's the question about addiction, but what about us succumbing to a cultural ADHD? You know, this thing that where we've got attention spans, let's spit that one out properly, that are increasingly shrinking, which, back to Neil Postman, this was something he bemoaned in Amusing Ourselves to Death. We moved from a print-based, text-based culture to communication through images, and then the flicker in images change, obviously in pop videos, maybe in a fraction of a second. And then we've got all this electronic access at our fingertips. How do we deal with the danger to become people who are ADHD electronically?
Well, I'm not sure how we deal with it apart from, behavioral changes and choices that people can make. But I do notice that We're doing research right now in terms of helping to develop younger leaders, and we're asking the question, how much of their of this new millennial culture should we be adapting to and adjusting for, and how much of it should we be pushing back against? In my world, leadership is still going to roughly remain the same, but they do have this ADHD component to them right now, which is...
Well, it might even be a saving grace. I mean, if it's going that fast, maybe you don't want to linger over certain details. So it's almost a way to deal with that kind of bombardment.
Yeah.
Because it's just such a narcissistic enterprise that you'd have to be pretty quick or you couldn't sustain it, right?
Yeah, I think you bring up a really good point. Because what is our capacity? Do you have capacity for 5,000 friends?
No. I don't.
Well, Jesus, it seems, had 12 friends. Obviously, he was involved in a very intentional leadership development process, but that would speak to, and in group dynamics, you know, you can only go so far with, oddly enough, up to about a dozen people.
Right. And when he fed the 5,000 and then the women and children who were there in that crowd, did he refer to them all as friends? Are they all close buddies? No.
Maybe they created a page called Jesus Gave Me Lunch.
Yeah.
And it had 5,000 subscribers.
Just because you know someone or know of someone, that just doesn't make you a friend. I mean, you could be polite to someone, you know, hi, how you doing as you're passing, and now you're friends?
Well, what about the issue of Sabbath, of unplugging, switching off? So how do you maintain the rhythm of Sabbath, which isn't just a day, but is a soul disposition?
Allison, we have friends, a friend who's a student at Trinity Western right now, and in one of her courses, they were offered extra marks if they would take a fast from social networking. And she did this for her term to get the extra marks. And we were talking to her afterwards and saying, you know, what was that like for you? What did you notice? Because all of her friends were angry at her because she's no longer communicating on Facebook or Twitter or
because they can't reach her.
They can't get in touch with her. And they've become so dependent on that. But when I said to Bailey, like, what are you experiencing? Yeah. She's going, I had more time.
Yeah.
I got my reading done.
Could focus being, on something.
Being cut off from people actually can help with focus and attention, and so it means that we are being robbed of something by the time and how much we put into it. Some people on Facebook even like the Hansons.
Remarkable.
Yeah.
Absolutely incredible. Now, when we're talking about Facebook, MySpace, Twitter, we're talking about electronic connection. In our conversation, we've drawn a distinction between connection and community, having followers and Facebook friends and real friends who know us. So there is this inbuilt God-given desire for community. How would you define community, Allison, if we're trying to say, hey, this really isn't community? What does the real McCoy look like?
Well, face-to-face time, experience together, shared experience, not just reporting on your lives, but actually sharing the moments, not just saying, you know, this is what I ate for breakfast, but actually having breakfast together so that there's a shared life. I think that is absolutely foundational. Yes, you can have like pen pal type friendships that, you know, develop. You know, I can understand that, and I have had some wonderful email exchanges with people that, yes, couldn't have happened any other way. That's true. I agree with Peter on that. But I just think that there comes a moment when you would have to actually share the actual experience with them. I think that's the key.
I went through a period about roughly a decade ago. I went through a period where I was sort of between churches. I'd sort of grown apart from the church I'd been in prior to that, and I had not yet joined a permanent church again. And there was a period of a few years where I found my community online, and it was a weird thing, and it was partly because I was processing a lot of issues, and rethinking my approach to certain things, and I was able to find people that I could discuss this stuff with, and we had some very in-depth conversations about a lot of things. Some in one of these discussion groups, somebody remarked at one point, gee, you try to start a flame war around here and somebody pulls out a Bible. You can't start a flame war here without a Bible study starting, because we just sort of, you know, flame war is the stereotypical, you know, people have this caricatured idea that when you're online, you're all just sort of ranting at each other.
And we
did that and we tried that, but it seemed like we always ended up actually looking at things more closely and discussing things. And I certainly would never say that was a satisfactory substitute for community, for church, for communion in every sense of the word, whether it's communing with people in the pew next to you or partaking of the bread and wine or grape juice, as your church may seem fit. But certainly, I think things like this can be a supplement to that, and I think that for some people, it can be, at certain times in their lives, it can be a way of getting through those times in their lives.
And some people are better writers than others, so that you can have maybe more connected conversations because, you know, you're a writer and you're probably connecting with other people who are writers. So
not that many of them were, though.
But you're right. We are limited by our ability to get our thoughts and our feelings out in
words.
Yeah, like
what about just a quiet walk with a friend, no one saying anything. Just the visceral experience of shared space.
Jim Houston wrote in his book on friendship years ago that I read that friendships are based on the mutual sharing of weakness. And I think that there's something in that. When you think about your closest friend, there's usually a time when you've had a tender moment of sharing weakness with one another.
Right.
And you see people sharing crazy things on Facebook, but I don't think it's what I'm talking about. I don't think it's a mutual sharing of, you know, those tender...
The vulnerability.
Yeah, the vulnerability, yeah.
Well, that's a good definition of friendship to wrap up this part of our discussion. We're going to take another break. We're going to refill our glasses and our mugs, and then we'll be back to harvest questions from our keen audience here at Bells in South Surrey in beautiful British Columbia. Thank you. All right, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, lads and lassies, it's that point in the Kindlings where I move around the room and get a chance to interact with our live audience and hear from them, their questions, their comments. And out the starting block tonight is Buzz with his comments, questions, observations for the panel.
Thank you, Bill. Folks, I am connected to a certain extent myself. I use Skype with my wife to connect with our daughter in Australia, and she didn't look like a Martian, but it was very choppy.
That's good. Okay.
I use email to connect with her. But my question is this. Is it just a replacement for the younger generation generally to enjoy a community without cost, a community without commitment, a community without sacrifice, just a shallow way of pseudo-community?
Yes, I'd say yes.
Thanks, Buzz.
By without cost, do you mean like they don't have to make the effort to get out the door, that sort of thing?
Yeah, without emotional cost, without physical cost, you can just stay on your... When we came here tonight, in the 10 minutes between the time my daughter got home and we left, she was on her laptop and on her cell phone and didn't have to move off the couch where she was also watching TV.
Right.
And so that's what I mean, is that there's no physical, emotional cost to this because you can just click and defriend someone.
Yep.
Somebody asked me to confirm them as a friend on Facebook the other day. I went through emotional anguish because I said, what if I don't? Will they jump off a bridge? Because I like people having friends. So I don't understand it, but I really appreciate the term communication, whatever you use, Carson. Rather than friendship, or somebody said it's just a communication point, that makes me less engaged, because if somebody wants to be my friend, to me that's a There's a cost to that. There's a commitment.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, I think I often just hit that ignore button, you know, for some people. But if you think of it as somebody wants your phone number, they want to have access to you. We are not talking about friendship here.
But I think a lot of people, even just in the way we talk about it, I mean, whenever I talk about my Facebook friends, I always refer to them as Facebook friends, you know, like, yeah. It's become this single word almost now that, like, you know, a friend with quotation marks around it. We just sort of, we know that there is real friends and then there's friends.
Facebook friends, yeah.
When you press ignore, can they tell that you're ignoring them, or do they think, oh, maybe you're not there?
Yeah, you haven't answered the phone. You know, you've just not picked up yet.
Okay, that's good.
Yeah.
All right.
Some boundary.
Yeah. Some of Allison's anxiety has been.
I signed her up for a page when we were on the break. Yeah.
And during the break, Allison Joe just accumulated 3,000 friends that she doesn't know. So that's pretty exciting. We've got Brenda, who's got something to say to our panel. Brenda.
Thanks, Bill. I've really enjoyed the conversation thus far. What I've noticed is that you all seem to agree on the disadvantages of social networking, and especially Facebook. And I'd love to know if there's anything good about it.
It's a little unnerving sometimes when you see different parts of your life colliding as they do sometimes, but I've actually enjoyed being able to catch up with people that I hadn't seen in years, and even if I don't really talk to them much, even on Facebook, just the fact that we have connected, so if I want to, I can check out their wall and see what's going on there. I like that. It's good. And friends of mine who've like left the country and they're in Australia. I've got a friend in Australia as well, and I appreciate that. It's also a way. I mean, one of the things that it's good for also is, of course, planning things. You know, like my kids had a birthday a couple of months ago, and so we planned a birthday party for them, and we invited people through Facebook, and some people RSVP'd and said we're going to be there, and some said they wouldn't. And again, you know, it's a support to existing friendships that already exist in meat space. I believe is the term for the real world, not cyberspace, but like, you know, here we are in our physical bodies and we actually do meet at the birthday party, but this Facebook app allows us to make those connections. And so it has its good uses. Yeah.
Carson, anything you want to add about positive aspects?
Oh yeah, I think that there's several positive things about Facebook. I think I see a lot of families using it to stay in touch with the extended family that are living in different parts of the world. You're not bound by time zones with Facebook, so you can communicate and leave a message there. It's kind of a moderated form of using email in that way, and there's a lot that do it. It's a great way to embarrass your kids because you can broadcast fully responding to their comments. So I have fun doing that at times. I think another thing is...
Embarrassing your kids is a positive, right?
Oh, yeah, it's a really positive thing.
Yeah.
Our one son runs a work for his church called The Basement, which is a venue for new artists, new musicians, etc. And he does almost all of the advertising for that using Facebook. They have a large group, and I'm always shocked by how effective that is, because he's hitting his exact target audience. So I think that those are all positive things.
All right, all positives. We're going to get another question from another member of our audience, Ralph, who's with us this evening.
Yeah, my question is, given that the bulk of how we communicate is nonverbal, you know, the body language, the eye contact, etc., what is becoming of a generation that will be what I'll call virtual communicators, and how is this going to impact us in dealing with life's human need for real relationships and intimacy? Because if we, as you said, Carson, create personal brands, what happens when the two brands meet and is in advertising, it ain't what, it's not as advertised.
Yeah. Yeah, I think, so much of our communication happens by what we see and experience, and a huge part of what even my communicating right now to you is what you're seeing. In the cyber world and the use of these social media networks, you're starting to see some phrases that are occurring in the sentence where a person will respond and they'll put in brackets, head tilted to the side, like they're actually giving visual cues that go along with the words, because the words themselves don't tell the story. And it's going to be really interesting to see what the outcome of all of this is, but we're not going to know until it's either too late, you know, to do much about. But I am noticing a lot more. Like I'll receive these little Twitter things, and it'll say, they'll have a comment, and then they'll put in these triangular shaped brackets, you know, big smile, to let you know they're trying to give you the visual cue.
LOL.
LOL, yeah.
I mean, hopefully this isn't too out of left field, but isn't this a dilemma that we Bible-believing Christians already sort of deal with in certain areas? I mean, doesn't Paul in one of his letters talk about, oh, I know what they say about me, I'm so unimpressive in person, but with my letters I thunder? This is a total paraphrase from memory. I'm botching it, I'm sure.
But yeah. Rather loose paraphrase.
But I mean, the point I'm getting at there is that Paul wrote his letters to people who had met him, right. And in his letters he even acknowledges that his verbal rhetoric in his letters might seem at odds with the personality that he projects when he's there in person. And we, reading these epistles and taking them as holy writ, we don't have the benefit that Paul's original readers had, because we never met him. And so all we have now are these words. And you wonder, if Paul wrote his epistles and he had things like head tilted to the side, like, you know, if he'd thought of that, what would he have written? I don't know. Mm-hmm. Could be interesting.
Wagging forefinger furiously. Yeah, that would probably give you an idea.
And it also, with emails and stuff, it just sort of vanishes into the ether. Uh-huh. And it's not printed. You don't keep letters, like, you know, wrapped in ribbon, right. And tucked in a drawer,
yeah,
because they
gone.
Were so special. It's just sort of, eventually they delete.
There is a permanence. We know, like, Barack Obama very successfully used Facebook and Twitter as part of the 2008 presidential campaign.
True.
But he made an offhanded comment about something, and that got uploaded pretty quickly. And, you know, then they deleted it, but it was too late. So there's a kind of quasi-permanence.
Yes, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
All right. We'll move on, and we'll give a voice to Andrea.
Actually, what Bill just said about having the permanence of what we say online actually speaks to, I guess, maybe more my comment. As Christians, we're told to live a life worthy of the gospel, and that's so much more invasive, or it's harder to do when we're online so prevalently. We might have a night of indiscretion, and while we may not post pics, someone else might and tag us, and it's on there for forever. Do you want to speak to the example that we as Christians, and also that we teach our children? As my child is getting older, and he'll be on Facebook soon, I mean, it's a real good teaching tool to talk about what you do is going to affect how people are going to see you.
I have a friend who's a leader of the largest camp in Ontario. And when they're hiring their summer staff, he has a whole team of people that are going on scouring the internet, scouring Facebook, MySpace, etc., to see how these young Christian leaders who are applying for these camp positions are in their other world, to see if there's consistency there. And so I'm concerned about the lack of filters that a lot of young people have when they post stuff out there that just goes out everywhere. I heard a great story about a friend of mine whose daughter, who has her N in our, you know,
driving
thing. So she's not supposed to have more than X number of people in the car, and absolutely no alcohol and everything. And one of her friends posted a picture of her with the car packed and open alcohol in the car. And his friend is a police officer, so he and he's a friend of hers on Facebook. So they had a little chat about that. But there's no discretion about that. And, you know, the Bible says that we're, you know, if you're a leader especially, we're to live lives that are above reproach. And I think we need to take that seriously when we think about our lives as portrayed. If you don't have anything to hide, show the world.
Yeah, but they'll kind of have to learn the hard way, right?
Right.
It would take a few of those mistakes, yeah. And then, I don't think I want to do that. Yeah. And that could be quite costly.
Or it could be, because it could be too late.
Yeah. You know?
And it's, well, I'm reminded of, this is maybe be a slight tangent, but I'm reminded of how, even with print, you know, like in the mid-1990s, I was an editor at the UBC student paper. And we used to say that the university student paper, that was the place, if you were interested in journalism, but you weren't sure, the student paper was the place where you could make all your mistakes, because it's terribly ephemeral. You know, we put out one or two papers a week, and it was just the student paper. Nobody saw it off campus. It's gone. After this issue is gone, it's gone. Mm. Well, the UBC library has now scanned in every issue of the UBC student paper going back to the 1920s, and they are all online in searchable PDF files. So all these things of mine that I thought nobody would ever see once I was out of school, I discovered this quite by accident when I was Googling something. I might have been looking for something of mine, but one of the search results that came up was this UBC library archive, and I went, whoa, like every single thing of mine is in there. So, and that's with print, but certainly online, it's very possible that things will follow you and haunt you, and you know, and I say this as somebody, I mean, Allison was saying that emails vanish. I've had an email account for 16 years, and I've kept virtually every single email.
Oh.
There's a few they're not that big. I mean, it's only a few hundred.
But do you print them?
No, I don't print them. I keep them on a hard drive.
He's just had four.
It's only a few hundred megabytes. It's only a few hundred megabytes a year, you know.
But if you don't print them and they're just always on the computer, how do you?
Every now and then I want to go back and see what I said about something, and so I can run a search. I can run a scan of the files on my computer.
And Peter's got friends at CTU.
Yeah.
And they can go back even before season one.
Yeah.
They can extract the emails. Mm-hmm. We're going to shift gears and hear from Ron, who's written copious notes here. Mm. And maybe he's living in a pre-electronic era. He's got a tablet and he's got a steel instrument here. Over to you, Ron.
Thanks, Bill. I'm going to agree with Postman a little bit here, but I took a positive spin based on the negative spin that I heard in the session earlier. But right out of the gate, I have to agree with Postman that TV was shallow, one unidirectional and whatnot, and he was commenting on that side of it. On the other hand, with the social media, we've actually gone multidimensional, and we have feedback and whatnot. So what he was complaining about from the TV era, in fact, has been cured by technology. The other thing that he spoke about is the plus and the minus of technology. Every technology's had some degree of positive and some degree of negative, sometimes more of one than the other, and it could go either direction. And we see that as well in all of these technologies. I'm going to take a little twist here, though, to some of the advantages of this. Right out of the gate, we hear the one-on-one being so important, Allison, but in fact, these tools are leveling the playing field for a lot of people who are disadvantaged in the one-on-one environment. They may be slower, fatter, uglier, or whatever, don't have the charisma or the ability to speak quickly. And this has leveled it right out for them. They can participate in the world, participate with very real thoughts that we might have discounted in another situation. And I think it's huge. Over to Carson on the leadership. I think we're seeing leadership evolution, and we need to step up to it. When we heard from Peter about organizing a birthday party, my son organizes a hockey team from scratch. It takes him 3 minutes. They show up, their fans show up, their schedule is there, they contribute. But the other thing that happens around leadership is that we get collaboration, we get input from more people. It's not this one down, the communication being the hard thing. It's not that at all. You put an idea out, and a broad base of people participate as equals in written form, think about their thoughts and put them down carefully, which is often better than the quick argumentative discussion on things or one-way things. So leadership has grown dramatically. If we'll grow with it, we can achieve a lot more. And finally, in closing, I think it's a relationship opportunity for a lot of people. there are people stuck in situations with work or life and whatnot that don't have a chance to get out and meet and greet and spend time with people one-on-one, and or they do in a small circle, but they can, or they're a little different in their way of thinking, and they can find like-minded people and have a relationship with them that isn't the same as that special relationship, you know, Allison alludes to that we'd all love to have. And I think it really is enabling an awful lot of that. There's plenty of negative too, which I'm happy to share, but you guys did a great job of that.
I want to echo what you said about how in the old days TV was, you know, things like TV were unidirectional, whereas nowadays it's not so much the case. I mean, you know, 20, 30 years ago, it was like the big three networks, and that was all it was, and they dominated the media, and they determined what, you know, the story was, that the narrative that people were living through. Whereas now, of course, they don't dominate the landscape at all, and we've seen very high-profile journalists lose their jobs, essentially, because they were reporting on things that were exposed to be frauds or shams or whatever, and because the blogosphere picked up on it, and people and anybody can contribute to that conversation in the blogs and so forth. And just in my own field, doing film criticism, a lot of people now have video editing capabilities on their computers, and so people are creating video reviews of films. They're creating their own, and of course, mashup trailers and things like that. People are increasingly empowered by the technology to retool those images into whatever they want it to be. And so now you see on YouTube, now you'll see underneath some of the videos, it'll say, this video is a response to some other video, you know, so that, yeah, it's not unidirectional at all anymore. And on some level, people are not as passive about the media as they used to be.
All right. So Peter's affirming about the medium not being unidirectional. So do we have a final comment from Allison and then from Carson about the possibilities, the pluses, and the perils of social media?
Yeah, I actually like the comment that it is quite inclusive, that it can connect with people that would otherwise be quite isolated. I thought that was a really good point. So in that sense, it has some perks. But I guess in my own life and experience, I find that it has isolated me more than included me in a way that makes me more hesitant to join in. I would prefer the more authentic kind of relationships in real life, and the cost of them over maybe the conveniences of instant messaging.
Carson.
But I've wondered tonight if some of the consumption of social media is actually a form of entertainment. It's like being with a bunch of people in a frivolous conversation, but it's entertaining. And the Ipsos Reid company did a survey in the fourth quarter of 2009, and the results are that Canadians are spending more than 18 hours a week online and 16.9 hours a week watching television. So there's 35 hours of time consumed there, and that's not all business. I think that there is an entertaining side of this. Now, is that good? Well, if you're giving 35 hours to that, something's missing. And I think
it's like a full-time job.
It is, yeah. Yeah.
So there's Carson's comments. Tonight we've talked about our capacity to get connected. We've identified that it's no substitute for community. And we remind ourselves that God is community, an eternal community, a circle dance of love, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. And God has created us to live in community, experience community with its joys and its challenges. And at the same time, particularly as we reflect on Carson's information there of 35 disposable hours of entertainment consumption, maybe we need to heed the words of Craig McNair Wilson, who posted this on his Facebook wall just the other day. He said, "Can you rest today? No email, texting, surfing, searching, calling, no calls except emergencies. Turn off your smart eye, bury, flip, no shopping. Do not enter any place with a free Wi-Fi sign on the door. You may write, scribble, paint, read, dream, bike, walk, make music, or swing. take a banjo lesson, spend too much time in a toy store, find a place to grab a bite where you can sit at the counter and they do not have a cappuccino machine. It's coffee, tea, or something with ice. Remember, and he was referring to Sunday, this is the day to keep holy. So there we are. Thanks so much for joining us this evening at the Kindling's Muse.